And we're back. I have Neil M. Goldsmith, PhD. He's a psychotherapist. He's been talking with us about his own experiences with psychedelics and healing. And we've also been talking about the MAPS conference, which is happening in San Jose, actually coming up in just a few days. And it's going to be a marvelous collection of folks talking about psychedelics and healing, in particular the research related to that. And we wanted to talk a little bit about some of the larger issues and questions related to how this whole experience kind of affects society and our collective evolution, perhaps. But there's been some things that have kind of been issues that have cropped up over the years related to not only research, but also the way that this whole question of the use of psychedelics, the way it's related to our experiences as a society. So, Neil, why don't you share some of those perspectives on some of those questions? You call them thorny questions that have arisen.
Right. Well, they're thorny because, you know, they've stuck around for a while. You know, in the early days of the research, and in one's personal use for that matter, in the beginning, the questions emerge, you know, of safety and efficacy. Does it work? Will we be poisoning people? You know, all of those early sort of questions that get resolved pretty quickly. And, you know, no, we don't poison people. So, you know, those sorts of things, safety and efficacy, are issues that are fundamental to the research, and they're being resolved. But over the decades since the new realm of research began in 1947, and now again in the in what we call the psychedelic renaissance since the early 1990s, there have been certain questions that have just stuck around and have really become deeper and more questions that need to be grappled with in a broader sense. And so some of those are, for example, people have talked about psychedelics as a, you know, nirvana in a pill, or, you know, that kind of thing, that it's going to transform you and make you, you know, into a bodhisattva. And, you know, so the question becomes, you know, does this experience last? Mm. You know, we all know about, you know, people who have, or our own selves who've had, you know, these wonderful experiences. And then, you know, over time, the experience fades. And I talked earlier about the importance of having, you know, a spiritual practice of some sort in your daily life that helps you give root to these intense, you know, epiphanies that one gets through psychedelics sometimes. And so the question is, you know, does the benefit or do the insights from psychedelics last? And, you know, I'm reminded of a little parable where we can all be seen as sort of walking up a mountain, the metaphor being to try to get to the peak and try to become enlightened. But in day-to-day life, you know, until we get to that peak, above the clouds, if you will, we're walking through the clouds, we're walking through the fog. And in this parable, you know, you were walking up this mountain path, we're heading toward the peak, but we're enshrouded in clouds and fog. We can't really see the peak. We can see a few feet in front of us, so we're not stumbling so badly. We're walking along the path, but we sometimes lose sight of the goal, of the peak. And so psychedelics can sometimes be seen as something that, you know, disperses the clouds temporarily. And one sees that peak as clear as day, and you know now, having seen it with your own eyes, that that peak exists, and you know, you remember why you embarked on this journey, on this path, and you're reinvigorated and re-motivated to continue. And then, of course, you know, the psychedelic experience goes away, and the fog comes back. And, you know, again, you can't see the peak, and again, you can see just a few feet in front of you, but you're re-motivated and reinvigorated to continue that journey. So, you know, does it last? Well, no, but there are things that we can do to make sure that the insights last. And as I said, any kind of really spiritual practice that is done that's integrated into one's life, done on a daily basis, be it yoga or meditation or some other approach that gets one back in touch with one's true deepest self and one's spiritual nature, not just seeing our lives in a material way, being animals in the world, trying to survive and eat and procreate and protect our offspring, all of which are fundamentally important, but also seeing, being in touch with the ground of our being, our spiritual nature, which can help us, you know, become more loving and helpful people who give love away instead of just simply trying to get resources for survival of our body, but actually giving love away. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's, you know, does it last? And then, you know, there's the question of is psychedelics, does the experience create a real spirituality? Or is it some kind of ersatz, kind of fake, or is it only nature mysticism rather than the true spirituality? You know, there's been a lot of debate upon that in the psychedelic research world, not so much amongst the researchers, but in the dialogue between the researchers and the folks who take psychedelics and those who don't, maybe the scholars of religion, for example, who mm-hmm. take a more academic approach rather than this experiential approach, or even the proponents of meditation as the way to go, and thinking many of them feel that psychedelics can be distracting. And so, you know, is it a real spirituality or not? You know, we can't resolve that question here, but because, the question is, well, what's the difference between the neurotransmitters that go through, that are triggered in one's brain when one has a psychedelic experience, or when one has a mystical experience? You know, they've brought in, yogis and sadhus from the East into laboratories. The Menninger work in the 50s, I think, is in early 60s is the most famous. And they strapped these folks up to electroencephalograms and observed their alpha waves and the different brain wave states, and observed that they could control their body temperature and control their brain waves and their neurochemistry mm-hmm. Through yogic practices. Well, you know, just because you can observe it through a scanning device or see it in chemistry through blood work, does that make it not a real spiritual experience? So we're getting here into the duality between mind and body, or between spirit and the material world. And part of what we're doing here, what we're all doing here, and we'll get to this again as we close this part of the discussion, is healing the duality, that very duality between spirit and the material world. It's all one thing. And the brain work is a really great example. You know, there's a substrate of neurochemistry that goes on when one has a mystical experience. But there is still the experiential aspect of the mystical experience, the direct experience in one's heart and one's soul, and one's, you know, what is a soul even? These are the sorts of questions that come up. And I said we're not going to resolve them now, but my perspective is that, you know, is it real? Is it a real spiritual experience, or is it just chemistry? And my answer is yes. That's really just one thing, two sides of the same coin. And our job is to see clearly that it's all one thing. It's like the lessons from quantum mechanics. I mean, if you look at the table in front of you, it's a solid object. But we know through science that it's really mostly empty space.
Yeah,
and if you go down deep enough and you dig deeper to the, you know, from the molecules to the elements down to the neutrons and protons and electrons, and down further that to the quarks, it gets to be, you know, the idea of matter versus energy begins to fade, and you realize that it's all patterned energy. So in a way, you know, that's my perspective, that it's really all one thing, and that spirituality, you know, you can't say it's not a spiritual experience just because you can tap and observe what's happening in the brain.
Well, and there's also this way to look at it, I think, which is more in agreement with the perspective that you're sharing here, is that there's a pattern of experience, and what psychedelics do in conjunction with human consciousness, there's a catalytic or a synergistic effect, perhaps revealing or accelerating the type of insight and connectedness and experience that is within us, and perhaps ready for that experience itself. And
yes,
we see that through the reports of people, many, many people, that tell us. And of course, there's such a diversity of experiences, but there are themes that come up out of these experiences which are remarkable and striking in their quality and also in many ways in their similarity. And maybe you'd like to comment on that.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're so right. There is this process of unfolding that we're pre-programmed to do genetically, to unfold into maturity, into quote-unquote spirituality, a vague word, but really it's not anything supernatural. It's a natural experience, this maturation, this unfolding, this getting in touch with one's spirituality. And it's why, if you look at the tribal societies, they use visionary plants at rites of passage, at the cusp points of personal development. And, you know, you can't, it's hard to generalize about tribal society because some tribal societies use psychedelics, you know, on a daily basis, and some of them use them, you know, the tribe uses them as a whole, and others, just the shamans use them. So there's a great diversity. You know, but in general, they're very helpful in this sort of deconstructing and then reconstructing one's sense of self at these cusp points, these rites of passage between youth and adulthood, between young adulthood and marriage and family, later on when one becomes an elder or during the dying process. These are transition stages that can be facilitated, you know, and traditionally have been facilitated by visionary plants. And so I think, you know, that again applies, you know, to this idea of, you know, that you're talking about transformation.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it applies in the practical world, in the Western world, in the research world, in terms of, well, how do we use these substances? Do we think of them as medicines, or do we think of them as sacraments? And once again, you know, when I see duality in my personal life or in my clinical practice, I by now it's a beautiful red flag going off saying duality. The alarm goes off, you know, go to integration, transcend to wholeness. It's not, whenever you see a duality, you can always recognize that neither end is going to be the answer. Neither side is going to win. You know, the Israelis aren't going to win and the Arabs aren't going to win. You know, it's like when you see this diametrical opposition, you always know that the solution, if there is one, is going to be through transcendent integration, through transcending the duality.
Mm-hmm.
So is it medical or is it sacramental? Yes, they're both the same, because the sacramental, the spiritual, acts on our bodies, on our brain chemistry. And the medical approach, as I said before, the operative variable is the peak experience, the religious experience, the ego death, seeing God. So it's very interesting how it redefines what medicine is. Because if you're a physician and you give somebody penicillin for, you know, an infection, it's a mechanical operation. Although, not to mention the fact that, you know, the penicillin works by triggering a bodily function, by triggering, you know, the body's own defenses into operation. So the body is what heals. But nonetheless, you know, you heal, you set a bone, or you do an operation, or you amputate a limb. These are all mechanical impacts. You know, but in the psychedelics research, you find that it's not so simple. That that what's happening is what can only be referred to simply as a spiritual experience. So if you're a physician and you're setting a bone, it's pretty clear 1 + 1 = 2. But if you're a physician and you're facilitating a psychedelic or a spiritual experience in your patient, and that's what's healing them, then how does the role of doctor change? And, you know, one has to broaden the umbrella to accommodate a broader worldview of how healing takes place.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a beautiful effect because, again, it addresses this issue of mind-body dualism, that good old René Descartes, the French philosopher, you know, I think, therefore I am, who first distinguished between, you know, who separated the spirit out of the material world and said, well, the spirit is the world of the church, and the hard, cold, you know, physical world is where you can be a businessman and you can charge interest. You know, the Catholic Church initially didn't allow people to charge interest. It was considered usury. Mm. It was not spiritually pure to do business that way. Well, you know, when the Industrial Revolution came along, that was swept away, and Protestantism came along, which said, oh, yeah, you can charge interest, no problem. So there was this duality created primarily by Descartes between the world of spirit, the world of God, and the world of man, the world of physical, you know, earthly affairs. And frankly, you know, that division has enabled us to build society, to charge interest, right, to have successful businesses, to generate wealth and surplus, and to use it to build societies. But, you know, as we all know, that process has also resulted in a degradation of the environment, mm-hmm. in an alienation from our true natures.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what we're all about these days in this time of, in this age of man, we're all about putting our shoulders to the wheel of the same purpose. And the purpose is to heal Cartesian duality, to reintegrate those two halves of our society, of our personal lives, and recognize that they're really one thing. But doing it now, having gone through industrialism and modernity, and even postmodernism, to go into a post-postmodern integral society where mind, body, and spirit are reintegrated the way they were in tribal society. But this time, with the facts and figures and knowledge that we've gained through the experience of becoming modern,
mm-hmm.
so that, you know, we're not really going back down to what some people call primitivism, which is a derogatory word, or tribalism, but really having a neo-tribalism or a neo-pastoralism where we become reintegrated with society and where we become whole and one again, but with our eyes open this time, Buddhist style.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another, you know, that's another one of those issues. And there's some issues, you know, in the research, which, you know, having to do with, you know, double blind experiments. And, you know, I mentioned that a little bit about the Marsh Chapel study, when everybody knows who got the placebo.
Yeah.
And there's a debate in the scientific world about whether double blind is necessary. The government requires it, and all of the studies use it. But it's interesting to grapple with that question of how effective it really is. And then, you know, with the new research that's coming about, and so much new research happening, and the results are coming in positively. You know, it's not like, you know, nirvana in a pill. It's not like perfect findings. The research results are not 100%, you know, but they're 90%.
Mm-hmm.
The research is coming in really strong. And so what do you do about training the new spate of researchers? How do you encourage medical schools, medical students and residents? How do you provide funding to train them? And then, you know, once they get trained and they're not just researchers, but now they're practitioners, how do you make it these substances available if they're working and if they're proved to be safe and effective, which they are being proved to be? You know, there's an old phrase in one of the commercials for, I think, aspirin, said safe and effective when used as directed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, safety and efficacy is what the FDA requires. So if you have both of those aspects, again, when used as directed, you know, personal use, individual use in the street, you know, recreational use, it's a whole other question, and we can talk a little bit about that too. But certainly there's certain, you know, conditions that apply for safety, and when those are in place, these substances are remarkably safe and remarkably effective. The most powerful psychiatric medicine or sacrament or both, you know, ever encountered. And so, you know, what about making them available under the right conditions for the use of therapists,
mm-hmm.
like myself? You know, I say over and over again, I don't use psychedelics in my practice because they're illegal, because the supply is to a, you know, on the street is uncertain. I don't have the training to do so, but that's changing.
Mm-hmm.
And in the next, you know, maybe 5 years or so, maybe that's optimistic, but I think somewhere in that realm, 5 or so years, you know, we're going to see psilocybin probably rescheduled from a Schedule 1 drug up there with heroin,
mm-hmm.
to a Schedule 2 or Schedule 3 drug,
mm.
when it's prescribable under controlled conditions in a therapist's office.
Wow.
So, you know, that's a process that's falling, you know, flowing from this wonderful research that we've been talking about.
Hmm. That it is fascinating. You know, it seems as well, as you were referring earlier in your own experiences, the cathartic process that can be accelerated with psychedelics then can take us to a place of lasting change, healing, you could say, certainly. It seems like there is an effect that goes on at the larger level, you could say the societal level, where we have now for gosh, what, going on 50 years, we've had an increasing awareness and experience of this in our society and perhaps even across the world. And it seems like this may be having some impacts on us. Now, certainly, we're starting to look more closely at the effect, but it seems like there are impacts that this is having on our day-to-day awareness. And I would imagine that you have some of your own observations related to that, and maybe you'd care to comment on the larger societal effects that this whole experience is having upon humanity.
Well, you know, I think I agree with what you said, and I think the psychedelics, I think of them as a wedge issue, like not so much a foot in the door or, you know, the nose of the camel into the tent where eventually the whole camel gets under. I don't mean like bait and switch in a way, but a wedge issue in the sense of transforming society. You know, psychedelics have been used, visionary plants have been used in every single society in the history of man. Mm. Where they've been available. I mean, the Eskimos can be excluded because there are no visionary plants up in the Arctic. But, you know, excluding that example, the only society that hasn't used psychedelics has been Western society. Mm. And look where that's gotten us. Mm. So I think there's a reason why, visionary plants have been a part of all cultures. And I don't just mean tribal societies. I mean, for example, the ancient Greeks. Who had, you know, the rites, the mysteries of Eleusis, mm-hmm. where an LSD-like substance was used in a rite of enlightenment. So even in, you know, the foundational society of modern society, the Greeks, you know, had that. And it wasn't until the Christian era that that psychedelics were abandoned or controlled. You know, there's this process over civilization where tribal peoples use visionary plants and they become very liberating, and you become in touch with the universe as a whole and with a direct experience of God. Excuse me. And it seems to me that, you know, as I observe, as society emerges, you know, through, tribal societies and later through the emergence of city-states and early nationalism, that there's a concentration of power in the government, in the military. And that, you know, as, you know, you can think of it as an example where, like, a warlord might march in with their troops to some tribal part of their realm and confront the shaman and say, you know, shaman, I want you to tell your people to be good citizens. I want you to tell your tribal, you know, people to fight in my military and to pay my taxes. Mm. And, you know, if they complain, I want you to tell them that their reward will be in heaven. That if they die in my battles, their reward will be in heaven. And the shaman says, no way. That's not what I'm about. And the tribal the warlord says, off with his head. And then he turns to the next shaman. And he says, will you tell your people? And if you do, I will give you stained glass. I will give you rubies and jewels and silk. You know, vestments, mm. and build a big church for you. Mm. And the next shaman says, okay, rubies and stained glass versus off with my head. Okay, fine, I'll do that. And so I think the powers that be kind of co-opted this beautiful, ground-based spirituality over time and consolidated power. And I think that's how a shaman who's a spiritual facilitator turned into a priest who's, in my opinion, really an arm of the state, and quite the opposite. Not just, you know, similar and different, but the opposite of a spiritual healer. Mm. And, you know, what happened, of course, successively was, you know, first we all take visionary plants for rites of passage and things like that. Eventually, no, just the priest takes it. And then eventually, the priest can't take it either. It's got to be a wafer or some denatured sacrament. Mm. And pretty soon, you know, the psychedelic experience, which can be, the visionary plants can be kind of corrosive. They didn't call it acid for nothing. It's kind of corrosive of submission to authority.
Yeah.
And that process, you know, is a danger to the state and to the accumulation of power and wealth. Mm. And so I think personally that's been a process that's gone down. And what's happening now, I think, is, you know, with global communications through the internet and just through transport, through, you know, jet transport, for example, where we become one planet, where this sort of integral Gaia approach to viewing our brethren across the planet is coming into play. We're beginning to really get a different perspective, and psychedelics then become for me a wedge issue that reintroduces that sort of ancient approach, that ground-based approach where everybody has a direct experience of the infinite, and does it again in the context of a post-postmodern world where we're not giving up on our knowledge and our the things we've learned through the mechanistic world, but we're recontextualizing them within a integral, sacramental sort of approach. And to me, that's the stage of life that we as a society are going through in this recent decades, and, you know, coming up a process of decades-long process of becoming, whole again. Mm-hmm. And healing the wounds to the planet and to our own, you know, bickering between nations. And maybe I'm overly optimistic, but I don't think so. I think that's where we're headed, and I think psychedelics are facilitating that process.
Well, it's interesting. If we stand back and take a long look at the, say, the psychological state of Western society, over the last few centuries especially, we can see it becoming increasingly isolated in terms of individual consciousness, you know, like going from the tribe to the village, and then from the village to the extended family, and then when the Industrial Revolution happens, then slowly we become the interchangeable parts, and we become more and more broken apart. And so there's this isolating effect that our experience has our society has kind of facilitated this isolation. And it's interesting that now the psychedelic experience comes to us, and there's not only healing, but there's also a way to begin to reintegrate and kind of, as you were mentioning earlier, to start to rebuild what we are, not only as individuals, but also collectively. I think it's very interesting, you know, the arc of experience that Western society has taken, and now this psychedelic experience seems to be very fortunately available to us to kind of help us to see it clearly and start to take a new direction, perhaps reintegrate.
Well, you know, it's funny, fortunate, you know, people sometimes observe that LSD was discovered right about the same exact time that the atom bomb was invented.
Yeah.
And that some people feel that, you know, somehow that came to us as a way, as an antidote to the threat of the atom bomb.
Mm. That's an interesting observation. Yes, I want to mention that we're having a conversation with Neil M. Goldsmith. We're kind of getting towards the end of our time, but Neil's actually, besides being a psychotherapist specializing in psycho-spiritual development, he's the author of a book called Psychedelic Healing, which will be out later this year. He's also going to be present at the MAPS conference, which is happening in San Jose just a few days from now. It'll be during next weekend. And he's going to speak at the conference, and he's also helping to MC a whole track at the conference itself. Why don't we tell everybody, with the few minutes we have left, Neil, what are some of the things you'd like to cover or reiterate from for the audience today?
Well, you know, there's one thing I sort of gave a little pause a few seconds ago because I was trying to think of one other thing, and what it is that, you know, there's this really sort of amusing, but I think very enlightening kind of anecdote or analogy that one can use about what's happened over the past, let's say, 40 years or so since the 60s. You know, in the 60s, society, you know, uptight 1950s society, very dualistic, you know, go to church on Sunday and the rest of the week screw your neighbor, literally and figuratively. You know, society was not really prepared for the psychedelic experience coming into our into society.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like with as an individual. You know, one of the biggest taboos in the psychedelic world is to dose somebody.
Mm.
To dose somebody means to slip them a Mickey, you know, to give them psychedelics without their without them knowing it.
Mm.
And, you know, if there's been untoward effects, you know, suicides and things like that, they've been, you know, primarily associated with that sort of experience. You can imagine, you know, having this experience that makes you feel that, you know, you're going out of your mind and not knowing why and thinking that, you know, you are indeed going crazy. So, you know, dosing is a big no-no. And when it happens, people, you know, freak out and have a, you know, frequently have a bad experience. You know, frequently they have a good experience, by the way, and just ease into it. But, you know, it's certainly possible and not uncommon for someone who's been dosed to have a very, very stressful, bad experience. And after the experience, to then say, I'll never do that again. No, that's terrible. What a bad thing. And society was kind of like that. You can think of the 60s as kind of like an experience of society being dosed without any preparation, without any, you know, reading, without any tribal history or grounding or understanding of spirituality or, you know, how this substance is facilitating our spiritual practices. None of that. Just, you know, all of a sudden society started experiencing this psychedelic revolution.
Hmm.
And society freaked out.
Yeah.
And society said, no, 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 it's a terrible experience. No, not only don't I want to do it ever again, but nobody can do it again. It's bad. Let's make it illegal.
Hmm.
And society reacted defensively. Okay. So now flash forward 40 years. And now we have the psychedelic renaissance. And now society has been convinced by the enthusiasts, basically, to try again. And society says, no, no, I'm scared. And so, and the researchers and the thoughtful, you know, theorists say, well, hold on a minute. You know, we all observed what happened in the 60s. We're all 40 years older now. And, you know, it didn't kill us. And, you know, all the fear and the horror stories about what might happen, you know, it didn't really happen so much. And we kind of understand that, yes, they're powerful, and yes, they're potentially, you know, fearful. But if one relaxes and breathes and, you know, reads the literature and prepares oneself and takes, you know, and surrenders to the experience rather than tightening up and resisting it, you know, it can be okay. And society has been essentially convinced to try again.
Hmm.
And so you see the research happening. And you don't see the same kind of reaction that happened in the 60s, where, you know, parents and newspapers are, you know, finding it to be dangerous and the headlines are blaring about, you know, danger, danger, danger. Now society's trying again in a more relaxed way. It's no longer being dosed with no prior experience or preparation. Now we've had the 60s and the intervening years as preparation. And society as a whole now, you know, isn't being dosed without its knowledge. You know, the people who are in positions of authority have been through the 60s. They're the baby boomer generation. And they you know, even if they weren't, even if they didn't take psychedelics, they watched others do it with, you know, no untoward effects. And so society now is more prepared. And so I think that the current research that's coming down the pike is being accepted. And I'm optimistic that that psychedelics will indeed be reincorporated into society, reincorporated because, you know, 1,000 years ago, it was an integral part of our societies.
Mm.
So reincorporated into society in a more thoughtful, measured way. And, you know, having said that, you know, you said I'm an expert on resistance to change, and on the societal level, you know, accepting research as opposed to resisting or, you know, letting the research gather dust on the shelf is a very important factor. But I think, you know, what's really interesting is, well, once psychedelics are indeed reaccepted by society, reintegrated into society, they then have their effect. It's not just a matter of doing the research in the laboratories and using it as a treatment for, you know, end of life anxiety, for example, or substance abuse. It's a redefinition of what medicine is all about, what science is all about, like kind of like the way quantum mechanics redefined science and you know, is it a particle or is it a wave?
Mm.
Well, no, it's a wavicle. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a new word for it now because we've integrated. And I think, you know, on the sort of psycho-societal level, that same process is happening again, that integration of opposites, that transcendence of duality, that integral wholeness. And so, you know, the implications of that for our society are as enormous as they get. I mean, in over the coming decades and even centuries, what impact will this wedge issue of psychedelics, which helped ease this this transcendence of duality and this integration into our whole planet, what effects that's going to have on the kind of way we deal with each other as individuals, mediated through the institutions of society? What about peace? What about hunger? What about pollution? How are we going to address these issues? You know, in the 60s, the environmental movement was born. Liberation, women's liberation and whatnot were born in those times. And in part, they were, you know, born from the kind of, you know, experience one has of the mess we've gotten ourselves into when one's in a psychedelic state, in a blissful state, and viewing it in a whole way, in a loving way. So, you know, and now we have health food stores on every corner, and so it's had its impact. But, you know, now reintroducing these substances, and over the long haul, over the decades, how it's going to change our society or heal these rifts and make us whole again, I believe that, you know, this has enormous implications, and really one of the most important factors in making the planet livable and making us love one another is reintroducing this sacrament, this these visionary plants and chemicals back into a standard, you know, practice of the way we go about our lives, the way we deal with religion, and the way we deal with you know, our fellow citizens of the world. The effects are incalculable, except you can see on the horizon, you know, all these wonderful words like integration and wholeness and transcendence and love and surrender. You know, all of the words that we learn about in our religious studies but are just words, to make those real and to integrate them into the structures and the operations of society, you know, it's just the opportunity and the prospects are totally beautiful, and it's what we've all wanted as a society all along. And I think, you know, mediated, triggered, facilitated by psychedelics, we have the opportunity now, I think, to actually achieve those huge, lofty goals. So I'm, you know, I'm just so thrilled to be a part of it in any way, and just happy to be a citizen of the planet at this point, you know, in our development.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it is a message that is very timely and hopeful. And, you know, I, honestly, before we had this discussion today, I didn't realize that there was such a huge momentum at work in the field with the research. It seems to me there's certainly a strong amount of momentum kind of among young people and old people who have had this experience. But it's also pretty amazing to hear your account of how this research is moving and flowering and developing in so many different ways. And this conference that's coming up seems to be a very fine manifestation and example of exactly that consciousness that you're expressing.
Well, yes, and by the way, you know, I think the conference is almost sold out. If you hurry up, you might get a seat. But if you do miss out on it, the presentations will be up on the internet. They're being videotaped, and so you'll be able to see them there. And once again, I'd like to encourage everybody who's listening to go to the MAPS, M-A-P-S, Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies .org website, and, you know, take a look at the conference materials and join MAPS. As I said before, it's a $35 donation, I believe, and gets you a lot of benefits, including a spectacular journal that comes out multiple times during the year. And it's a way to contribute to this process. You know, if you believe in it, we can't all be researchers, and we can't all, you know, be facilitators using the substances, you know, with in our work. But we can join an organization like MAPS and support what they do. And it's a good way to, you know, to have to make an impact and make a contribution.
That's very good. And let's tell everybody your website and your book again, so that they can connect with you and find out more information about your work, Neil. The book is Psychedelic Healing: The Promise of Entheogens for Psychotherapy and Spiritual Development, due out later this year. And your website is neilgoldsmith.com, is that right?
That's right, just my name.com.
And, Neil is N-E-A-L, neilgoldsmith.com.
Thanks, Tony.
You bet. And I know there are places where your interviews are available on the web as well. If someone does a search for your name, are they likely to be able to find archives of your interviews?
Yes, that's right. You know, my website is my clinical practice, and I don't really focus on psychedelics at the website itself. But if you Google my name, especially if you put my middle initial M in there to distinguish me from the other Neil Goldsmith, who's a chemist out there, you'll find lots of material stuff. I've done it at the MAPS, that's published at MAPS, and other stuff. There's interviews, radio interviews, and publication. I had an article in a wonderful textbook called Psychedelic Medicine, a two-volume psychiatry textbook out by the Prager Publishing Company in 2007, and I have an article in there called The 10 Lessons of Psychedelic Psychotherapy Rediscovered, and it talks about the similarity between tribal wisdom and now the modern research findings that are coming out, and how in some sense in the West we've been reinventing the wheel of tribal wisdom. So, you know, and if you want to, just, you know, my email address is on my website, but it's basically Neil, N-E-A-L, at Inch, I-N-C-H, .com. That stands for Internet Channel, but it's Neil at Inch.com, and you can just send me an email, and I'm happy to send you a PDF of that chapter and, you know, interface with you in any way. You know, I love to build community, and I'm happy to receive, you know, email inquiries, and, you know, I'm happy to answer some questions and interact with you. So feel free to contact me if you want to.
Well, I appreciate you sharing your experience so openly and your insights, and I'm grateful for your work with MAPS. And, you know, thanks for being available for this discussion today.
It was my pleasure. It was a great discussion, Tony. Thank you for facilitating it.
Oh, you bet.